All right. Oyez, oyez, oyez. United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Coral Wong, each presiding. All of business before this court draw near and will be heard. God bless the United States and this honorable. Please be seated.
Good morning. I'm Judge Coral Wong Peach, and I'm joined by Judge Meredith on my right and Judge Falvey on my left. We are convened today to consider arguments in the matter of Josephine Duckett versus Douglas A. Collins, Secretary of Veterans Affairs, case number 23-4348. Will counsel, beginning with appellate's counsel, please enter your appearance for the record.
Good morning, Your Honor. For the appellant, Josephine Duckett, Sean Raven, and also Jeffrey P. Gerber.
Good morning, Your Honor. James Drysdale for Appellee Secretary of Veterans Affairs. With me is Melissa Timbers, Deputy Chief Counsel.
Thank you. Would appellate's counsel like to reserve some time?
10 minutes.
10 minutes. Okay, thank you. Now, if counsel is ready, we'll begin with appellate's counsel.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm sorry that Mr. Carpenter was unavailable to be here today, and I wish him well. As the Federal Circuit wrote in Smith versus McDonough, time spent reviewing the record is indispensable to pursuing any appeal, regardless of how many issues are ultimately appealed, and regardless of the degree of success. The unambiguous rule of law is that in the context of EJA, time spent reviewing the record before this court is indispensable. This rule of law creates a judicial presumption that time spent reviewing the record is necessary. The Secretary has offered no evidence other than his own apparent conclusion that a review of the record was unnecessary to achieve success in this appeal. While the court has wide discretion to determine what is a reasonable attorney fee, it does not possess discretion to determine that review of the record was unnecessary to achieve success in an appeal. The court has previously held that under Sperry versus Shinseki, 8.3 hours to review an 844-page record was reasonable, and the Secretary has conceded that counsel's review of the record is reasonable pursuant to Sperry. Sperry is controlling authority. It has not been reversed by any subsequent decision, and it has not been overruled by the full court. At this point, Smith is controlling. Smith is controlling as to whether or not it's indispensable to review the record. What is necessary is also reasonable. Attorneys have an ethical obligation to review the full record every time. They have an obligation under Model Rules of Professional Conduct, Rule 1.1 and 1.3. Rule 1.1 is competence, and 1.3 is diligence. An attorney is required to be competent and provide competent representation, requiring preparation. And preparation requires reading the full record. In this matter, counsel was required to review the full record in order to provide a summary of the issues pursuant to the court's order under Rule 33. Rule 33 requires that the appellant's counsel create a memo, a summary of issues, and serve it on the secretary as well as with the court's central legal staff. The court's rules also require that that memo include citations to the record and to authority. There is no way to provide citations to authority and to the record without reviewing the full record. The Model Rules of Professional Conduct also require that an attorney advocate candor towards the tribunal and not file any frivolous pleading. To do this, an attorney must be fully familiar with the record and must be able to establish that there is a reasonable basis in fact and in law for every position taken and every pleading, as well as any statement made to the court. Questions?
Yes, I do have a couple of questions, Mr. Raven. The difference is, do you see any difference in Smith case in your case? I mean, in the Smith case, there were more than one issue, and the counsel prevailed on one, the appellant prevailed on one of, I think, six issues. And number two, in Smith, the first time the attorney touched the case was when it came to our court. Otherwise, the record had been developed by the VSO or something else. So in that case, do you think that affects?
There are factual differences between the case in Smith and this matter. But those factual differences don't necessitate a difference in the conclusion of law. The conclusion of law from the Federal Circuit is that review of the record is indispensable in any appeal. And it's indispensable to the success in any appeal. The argument that there is only one issue and therefore that issue makes it less necessary to review the entire record is totally misunderstands that there are many issues actually before the court. For example, what is the court's jurisdiction? Does the court have jurisdiction over the appeal? And also whether or not whether or not there are elements that are satisfied by the appeal. For example, whether Ms. Duckett was a qualified accrued benefits beneficiary, whether or not she filed a substitution, whether or not that substitution was granted. There are other issues are whether or not whether or not the board's error was prejudicial. And those require a full reading of the entire record. Now, those issues weren't brought up, and I didn't bring them up. Counsel didn't bring them up at the time of the conference or at the time of the summary of issues, but it wasn't strategically required or necessary or even a good idea to bring up other issues. It was strategically important to have the secretary agree that there's one issue, and on that one issue, the secretary was not going to prevail.
So as to that list of questions that you just said needed to be answered, and that's why a full review of the record was required, you represented the veteran before the agency in his request to get an earlier effective date for TDIU. That was the merits issue that was before the board, and then represented the appellant in seeking substitution before the agency and seeking DIC benefits. So of those questions that you just listed of was she an accrued benefits beneficiary, did she timely file substitution, did you already know the answers to those questions based on your prior representation of the veteran and of the appellant?
At the time that we filed, looking at the record, if you look at the timeline of events, the case went back. Mr. Duckett was granted entitlement to a TDIU, and then he filed a notice of disagreement with that. And he filed a substantive appeal. It was appealed to the board, and we filed a short letter or informal brief to the board showing that he was entitled to an earlier effective for TDIU. After he died, we filed an application for substitution for Mrs. Duckett. So, yes, we had an idea at that time that Ms. Duckett would be entitled to these, but these were theories. While we knew that there were while we thought there are answers that our client was entitled to these benefits, this appeal was dismissed. And when it was brought here to the court, we still had a duty under Model Rule 1.1 and 1.3 to review the entire record to check, because there are different questions. For example, there is no question before the board about whether or not the board has taken into account the rule of prejudicial error. These are different questions. These are different issues.
So as to that question, though, you had represented the veteran before the agency seeking entitlement to an earlier effective date for TDIU. Would you not already have known that it wasn't a frivolous claim in seeking or frivolous matter in seeking that earlier effective date?
We don't believe it would be a frivolous matter, but we still had an obligation to review the record to think about what the opposition or our adversary would come up with as arguments. Because these are different arguments that can come up as a result of a change in law, a change in circumstance, or a period of time. As far as reviewing the record, I'm sure you're aware there's no VA claims file anymore. It's no paper file. It's all different databases. So we're never really entirely certain what is before VA and what the board is looking at. We don't have access to VA calls. And while we have access to VVMS and we have access to certain records, Capri, it's the Wild West. We have no idea what the board is looking at in terms of the entire record. When Ms. Duckett's appeal was dismissed, we didn't have any firm idea why it was dismissed. We had an idea that maybe there was a mistake that was made. But if you look at page, I think it's page 60, page 83 in the record, you see that there's a letter that says that substitution has been granted to Mrs. Duckett. And in page 83, you see Ms. Duckett's address on there. There's no date on that letter. It was never sent to her counsel. And because there's no date, there's no understanding of whether or not that's an official letter. So we didn't have any idea whether or not that was an official document or a draft document. If it's the secretary's contention that that's an official record, then that's an indication that there's no presumption of regularity because we can't determine whether or not that was an official record or whether or not that was just a draft. It was never actually provided to counsel. We were able to pick up that document from VBMS many, many weeks after it first appeared in VBMS. But again, we didn't know whether it was draft or not. There's no date on it. And if you look down below, there's no indication that a copy would be sent to counsel. So again, even though we had an idea about some underlying facts of Ms. Duckett's case and Mr. Duckett's case when we're before the board, the record before the court is entirely different. There are different issues than there were before the board. And we are ethically required to review the full record.
Is that, I think you're acknowledging that you had some familiarity of what you would find in the record. Would you agree to that?
Some familiarity doesn't.
Okay. And is that familiarity perhaps reflected in the rate at which you reviewed the record? I mean, you reviewed at a rate of over 400 pages an hour, I think.
1,000 pages for every 2 hours.
Okay. So there's no close to 500. And that was reflecting that I'm familiar with what should be in here. And I know what I'm looking for because I know what the issue is going to be here. It's a substitution issue that they missed some stuff. So I know what I'm looking for. I can go through this pretty fast.
Yes. If you look at the billing and the itemized timesheet, you can see that counsel was able to review. I feel able to review the record at a fairly quick clip. If you're talking about Sperry's review of 8.4 hours to review an 800-page or 844-page record, we weren't anywhere near that rate. We were much faster.
Right. And this goes to the reasonableness of the hours.
I think that demonstrates abundant reasonableness. I mean, even the secretary's conceded that.
So I want to explore then your understanding of Smith, because I want to make sure that at times in your briefing, maybe it's Mr. Carpenter's briefing as well, it seems to me that you're saying that any time devoted to record review is compensable. And I want you to tell me that's not what you're arguing. If that's not what you're arguing,
your question is any time is the actual time used to review the record compensable?
Any amount of time. Are you arguing that there's a per se categorical rule? Record review is compensable no matter how much time it takes.
No, I think if you look at Sperry has established as a rule of law that if you are reading a record at a rate that's faster than 100 pages per hour, then that's reasonable.
Well,
I don't understand your question.
I guess my question is are you saying it's per se compensable, a categorical rule, all record view time, no matter how much time?
No, because it's not no matter how much time, because there's Sperry. But as in general, there's a presumption that record review is necessary. And as long as that record review meets the Sperry standard, then it's reasonable.
Per se?
It's reasonable under Sperry, not per se. I mean, well, yeah.
But you understand your Sperry is that it's a per se rule?
Yes, okay.
Okay.
Okay. So if you're asking whether or not something like the Andrews factors can be considered, whether the court should take into account whether time spent is unreasonable because it was excessive, redundant, or that there's any evidence, as opposed to conjecture, that it was at the time spent was unreasonable because it was based on disorganized efforts. And I think that I don't think those really apply after Smith. I think that there's a per se rule that the actual time, as long as it meets that requirement under Sperry, is acceptable. It's reasonable. So when you talk about
we're back to your understanding of Smith then. Aside from Judge Peach's question about whether or not Smith is limited to a particular scenario, they do say on page 1342 of Smith, the principle in this case, Smith, and equally important in future cases, is whether in a case in which not all claims succeed, an appellate counsel who spends significant time initially reviewing the extensive record of the case in preparation for representing a client on appeal is entitled to recompense, or can it be fractionally proportioned? So that's a very specific question, not arising under the facts here, okay? But setting that aside, Smith says, the law requires that Mr. Smith's counsel be compensated for time that was necessarily expended. And they say that in the context of the question of, or the relevant inquiry, is whether the time spent was reasonably expended. So you'd agree with that, that it's got to be time that's reasonably expended?
Sure, but okay. What Smith says is the time spent by Mr. Smith's attorney on initial record review was necessarily expended on preparation for developing the case, including the successful claim, and would have been necessary for any appeal. It doesn't matter whether or not someone represented.
I understand. Okay. I'm trying to understand your the analytical construct we're supposed to apply to this. Okay, so I'm trying to understand. Are you saying that Smith is preclusive of a reasonableness test?
No.
Okay.
Stop there.
No. So a reasonableness test applies. Correct? Yes. All right. And Andrews governs that?
No. I respectfully say no. I respectfully disagree. Andrews doesn't, because when you talk about excessive, redundant, or disorganized time, you have to explain why it's excessive, redundant, or disorganized.
Okay, so what's the reasonableness test? What are the factors of the reasonable test?
The reasonable test, it's Sperry. It's whether or not a counsel reviewed the record at a rate faster than 100 pages per hour. That's the reasonableness test. And other than that, we disagree with the idea of having a multi-pronged approach to reviewing whether or not something reasonable based on just the secretary's conjecture that the time spent reviewing the record was not necessary. The secretary has argued that the entire time for the merits review in order to draft the summary of issues was unreasonable. That's purely a conclusion. It's conjecture. There's no context behind it, such as the number of pages. And the secretary has conceded that based on the number of pages reviewed in this speedy review, that was reasonable.
If I could change direction a little bit here, as you know, the secretary has argued in part that it is unlikely that a private client would have agreed to pay for this roughly $4,000 for 14.1 hours of time for you to review page by page the record. Is it your position that a private client would pay an attorney over $4,000 to do a page-by-page review when that attorney had represented the client and her husband for more than a decade?
I believe that there's a recent case, it might be a single-judge decision that was written by Judge Peach, which talks about how it's important to review the record at every different level of a tribunal, whether it's before the board, or before the Veterans Court, or before the Federal Circuit, before the Supreme Court. My answer is a private client would expect counsel to be competent and diligent in their representation, requiring preparation. If this case were to go to the Federal Circuit, it would be competent and diligent for that attorney, or for me as the attorney, even though I've already read the record, to read the record again, to understand the bases, to be able to come up with the theories. There are different theories, different standards of review, and different arguments.
To the extent that review, though, of the record is refreshing your memory or double-checking your prior work? Because as you said, you represented the merits below for the veteran and seeking an earlier effective date, and you represented the appellant in seeking substitution. So to the extent you may have been refreshing your memory or just making sure no documents were missed, would some amount of billing judgment be required there to not bill all of that to the client?
Billing judgment is reflected in the speedy review. 1,000 pages every 2 hours is quite speedy. I can't really contextualize 1,000 pages in 2 hours. But that reflects that we're able to fly through to see whether something piques our interest in being relevant or not. So that's an exercise of reasonable billing judgment if you look at the rate of review. I think a client would expect their attorney to be prepared. Part of that preparation is reading the record. Reading the record is indispensable in every appeal, whether it's before the board, this court, or the federal circuit, or the Supreme Court. Reviewing the record is necessary.
But in this case, wasn't a majority of the record consisting of medical records, which have nothing to do with the issue that was brought before this court, which was a substitution of issue because Mr. Duckett had died?
So the issue, so your question, as I understand it, is why was it relevant to review certain records?
No, records? Well, we spend as much time on it if they're not relevant.
Well, we have to review all records to determine whether or not they're relevant or irrelevant. In a medical record, you might find something surprising that has nothing to do with the medical record, whether or not Mr. Duckett was working at the time, whether or not Mr. Duckett was divorced.
But the issue was substitution of Mrs. Duckett.
The issue was substitution that I presented in the summary of issues, but there are many issues. One was that the court has to take due account of the rule of prejudicial error, which means whether or not there is anything such as that would indicate to me that the error was non-prejudicial. Required to review all the records under the model rules of professional conduct. I have to review everything. Thank you. My time's up.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you.
May it please the court. The text of the Aegis statute contains a limitation on the attorney's fees that this court may award. They must be reasonable. This textual statutory limitation means that fees may not be awarded for time spent on tasks that are unproductive or duplicative, or for time spent on permissible tasks that is excessive or redundant. Such time is unreasonable under controlling authority. Taxpayers are to bear the cost only of reasonable fees which were actually necessary to gain the relief from unjustified government action. This reflects Congress's intent to strike a balance in the Aegis statute by removing financial barriers to claimants seeking to vindicate their rights, but to minimize the cost of that redress to the government and to taxpayers. The bottom line, this court may not authorize an award of fees for any useful work, but only for work that is necessary to achieve the result achieved. In other words, while Aegis is a fee-shifting statute, it's not a blank check. In this case, the court should find that appellant has not carried her burden of establishing that the amount of time billed for review of the record was reasonable, and that the total amount of time, and has not explained why the total amount of time was not excessive or redundant under the facts and circumstances of this case, where the scope of the appeal was limited to a jurisdictional issue and a single operative fact about substitution. The applicable standard for this court to apply is a multi-factor test that's consistent with the court's case law in Chesser, Ussery, Andrews, and McCormick, which are all variations of the same reasonable reasonableness test and require a fact-based, contextualized assessment to determine reasonableness. That test is flexible enough to include traditional factors that courts have always looked to determine reasonableness under federal fee-shifting statutes, and also flexible enough to address emerging issues, such as the billing for the reasonableness of time billed by attorneys using AI. Here, the Secretary respectfully requests that the court issue a decision that clearly articulates the applicable test and applies it with fulsome reasoning to serve as practical guidance for all to understand the contours of the court's jurisprudence here. The Secretary welcomes the court's questions.
What's your response to Mr. Raven's Sperry argument?
Judge Falvey, Sperry does not create a per se categorical rule that any time billed for record review that is faster than 100 pages per minute is reasonable. Reading Sperry, the reference to the page per hour seems almost incidental. The real discussion and analysis there was about the necessity of the review by another attorney after the original attorney had a conflict of interest. And then the issue is about the reasonableness of the review by the attorney who came in to take over the case. That's not the situation we have here. And the court, in looking at the amount of time that the new attorney had to spend going through the record at the late stage, mentioned that that rate seemed appropriate. But the holding of that case did not create a categorical per se rule that anything in excess of that amount of time is reasonable. That should still be based on the facts and circumstances of any particular case.
And you're not, are you suggesting a categorical rule that you can never get time for record review if you represented below or you're familiar with the record?
No, Your Honor. That is not the Secretary's position. And I would like to clarify because appellant's briefing does attempt to reframe the Secretary's position in that way, but that is not the Secretary's position. It's a determination that must be made under the facts and circumstances of that case, and it's contextual. So there may be instances where the review is reasonable. For example, temporal distance in the representation, if it's been 15 years since...
We have here.
Right. So that may be one factor, but that's not dispositive on its own, and neither is the rate. None of these factors are controlling individually. All of these are things to that the court should appropriately consider when determining whether the amount of time billed has been reasonable. Now, the Secretary in this case did not challenge all of the record review time that appellant's counsel billed in the EJA application. At the beginning of the case, there were a number of hours billed to review the RBA, to index the RBA, and the Secretary has not challenged appellant's billing for any of that time for review of the record. So to the extent appellant has said that the Secretary claims that review of the record is unnecessary, that's just not borne out here. It's not our position. It's not, that would be contrary to the arguments we presented in the facts of this specific case. We did not challenge all of the time. Our position is that the amount of time may be affected by those factors, and that an appellant must demonstrate in their EJA application why the time they're billing is not duplicative or redundant or excessive if these issues are reasonably raised, if there has been prior representation. In this case, the attorney represented the appellant in a substitution proceeding before the board. When the board then issued a decision dismissing the appeal because there had been no substitution. The Secretary's position is that that limitation on the that limitation of the issue, that narrow jurisdictional issue, and the representation by appellant's counsel on the substitution matter should have provided at least some background to where appellant's counsel could realize efficiencies in the record review. So, for example, in this case, we noticed that the record, the merits record review that appellant's counsel billed for started at the bottom of the RBA at page 6,000 something from, you know, the earliest date in time, the DD-214 and original claim, all the way up to the present. But having the background knowledge that the substitute party had already been substituted, it may have made more sense to review the record from the top down.
You
substitution documents would have been first.
Are you suggesting that they didn't have an obligation to review the entire record, though? Because it seems to me if you have an obligation to review the entire record, it doesn't matter where you begin.
Well,
and chronologically might make.
Right. And so, again, the Secretary, appellant's counsel has billed for reviewing the entire record. Appellant's counsel billed time at the beginning of the case to review the entire record for legibility, for completeness, to verify the documents that were in the record. This is all detailed in the billing statement. And then at that point, the entire record has been reviewed by appellant's counsel who's billing for that.
What they call merits review is the one you're challenging.
That's right, because in the substitution context, and in this case, the board dismissed the appeal saying there was no substitute party, but appellant's counsel had represented appellant in the substitution proceedings. She had been substituted. I mean, that was a clear error, you know, on the board's part, and that was addressed. But the fact that that appellant's EJA application identifies that the record was reviewed completely at the beginning of the case, that those records were indexed, appellant's counsel should have then, on the merits, been able to flip directly to the substitution motion and see that it had been granted and has not explained in the application why all of those 14.1 hours for merits review from the earliest date forward is reasonable under the facts and circumstances of this particular case. And the Secretary's argument really is it's not a categorical one. It's that appellant has not satisfied their burden of demonstrating the reasonableness of the fee. They have not explained why the requested fee is not duplicative, excessive, and redundant under the facts of this case, with the limited jurisdictional scope, with the prior representation. All of those factors were reasonably raised and should have been addressed in the EJA application under the Secretary's view.
So, counsel, it looks like you're taking objection to hours that are noted for May 15, 2024, billed at 2 hours for RBA merits review, for drafting rule 33 memo, taking notes, then he cites the pages. And this is done 7 times. Those are the 14 times two, 7 times 2 hours. Those are the 14 hours that you're taking umbrage to?
Yes, Your Honor, just the merits review portion that has been billed.
Well, and then based on the fact that you feel that the appellant did not justify the reasonableness, how would you have, what would you have had annotated on this to show your point?
Well, Your Honor, I believe what, the descriptions that appellant has provided Under different circumstances and under a different factual situation may be sufficient. The appellant has the burden to prove to provide adequate documentation of the reasonableness of the hours. That's from this court's decision in Chesser. If that's done and those descriptions show that the time billed was not unreasonable in its face, contrary to any of the factors in the court's case law, including Hensley Note 3, footnote 3, or they have not been persuasively opposed by the secretary, then the court generally will presume that the time billed is accurate and will not really look a lot further because it's if it's not unreasonable in its face. Appellant's argument, we believe, really condenses those three different steps or those three different things the court should look at into one. Only
those three steps being those three different
If it's unreasonable on its face, if it's not contradicted by any of the other factors in the court's case law, or if it's not persuasively opposed by the secretary. And that comes from Chesser. And so those are the three things, the three hurdles that an EJIA application must clear. And appellant's counsel's argument, would really only allow for the court to find time unreasonable if it's unreasonable on its face. It wouldn't really allow the court to, with regard to record review time, look into the either of the second categories, whether that time's been persuasively opposed by the secretary or whether it is contrary to the court's case law, including Ussery, Chesser, and also the factors set forth in Hensley footnote 3 by the Supreme Court, which referenced the 12 factors from Johnson v. Georgia Highway Express, which set out the 12 traditional factors that courts had looked to in fee shifting cases historically. So the time billed in that application might be reasonable under certain circumstances, but appellant hasn't explained why that time is not duplicative, excessive, or redundant given the context of this case. And that all falls within that second category. Time may not be deemed reasonable and fees may not be awarded for time by this court if it is unreasonable under the court's case law. So duplicative, excessive, redundant, et cetera.
How would you respond to the appellant's argument that counsel would not be able to create the statement of issues without going through the record individually to have the record citations? Is it tied to what you said, that there was some hours spent early on indexing the record?
Yes, Your Honor, because again, appellant has billed for review of the entire record here in this case, the facts we have. The EJIA application details that the entire record was reviewed, that the accuracy of the documents therein was confirmed. That would include the substitution document showing that the appellant had been validly substituted, and those were indexed. So when it came time to prepare the summary of issues, appellant's counsel should be able to quickly tab to the substitution decision, see that substitution was granted, and then prepare a summary of issues stating that the board's decision was wrong to dismiss the claim for the lack of any substitute party without having to spend an additional 14 so hours going through the veterans VA medical records, which have nothing to do with Mrs. Duckett's substitution. So the fact that RBA or record review is indispensable in any appeal is not contrary or even in tension with the secretary's position here, because appellant's counsel did bill for review of the entire record in this case. So to the extent appellant's argument is that the secretary says that our record review is unnecessary. That's simply untrue. And we did not challenge all of the record review time here. We're only challenging a portion of it that we believe was not necessary or was unproductive under this court's case law and therefore unreasonable.
So you would allow for a reduction in the 14 hours?
Well, Your Honor, ultimately that could be an appropriate resolution because the time there does also seem to include drafting of the summary of issues. But the problem is that it is a block billing. So those are all included together. And there's, you know, that then becomes appellant's burden to demonstrate the reasonableness through the EJA application and explain which portion of that time was for the record review, which portion was for actually drafting the summary.
Well, but I mean more that they should be allowed compensation for the merits review of the substitution issue. That they've gone through the entire review, indexed it, and now they need to go back and say, okay, now we need to go to those pages and review those pages so we can put together the statement of issues.
Sure.
So some period of time of that 14.1 was devoted to the question which they prevailed upon.
Yes, Your Honor. So that is correct. There is a portion of the record that contains the documents about substitution, et cetera. And so that is related to the issue upon which appellant was successful. However, appellant did bill for review of the entire RBA and did bill to index the RBA. So appellant has billed for reviewing those records in this EJA application and did not explain why the additional review was not duplicative or excessive under the facts of this case. Had it been broken out that way and discussed and itemized in the billing statement that way, that particular portion may not have been included in the secretary's challenge. I think that's a reasonable concession. And the secretary would like to highlight that the applicable standard here for the court to assess, the court really stands in the shoes of a reasonable paying client. And the Hensley case says that. It's not, you know, whether it was reasonable for an attorney to review the record or to do that. It's whether a reasonable paying client would pay their attorney to review or re-review portions of the record that had already been reviewed. And to determine that, the court looks at these factors, such as whether the review was duplicative or redundant. And in a situation where counsel has represented both the veteran and the appellant below, and specifically in the substitution proceedings that were the controversy in the board decision, it would not be reasonable, the secretary submits, that a reasonable paying client would pay their attorney to re-review records, the veteran's medical records, in that situation. They're irrelevant to the issue that was decided by the board for substitution, its jurisdictional decision, and it's potentially duplicative or redundant. And so even if technically it may be possible for appellant's counsel to bill for that time, the secretary submits that a reasonable client would not have paid it, and thus it should have been eliminated in the interest of billing judgment. Appellant's counsel emphasized the model rules of professional responsibility and counsel's professional responsibilities. But the responsibility for billing judgment originates from professional responsibilities. So, you know, there are two sides of that equation, two sides of that coin. Yes, there is a responsibility to be fully aware of the facts of a case and the prior history. And I think that's what Smith emphasizes, that a counsel must be familiar with the merits of a case. It doesn't say that the only and exclusive way a counsel may obtain that information is by billing for review of the entire record on the merits in a duplicative fashion if there's been prior representation.
Smith makes much of the fact that much of veterans benefits law is pro se at the agency and then maybe represented up here. Smith was that scenario, I think, and that it would become certainly more necessary for a thorough, time-intensive review of the record when you don't represent below.
And that's true. I believe that's correct. And
is that a cabining of Smith some that it's really talking about? It's maybe factually limited?
I believe so, yes, Your Honor. At least that's one thing the court may consider. Smith really emphasized that the attorney there had come into the case at the Veterans Court, had not had that type of prior knowledge about the facts of the case, the prior procedural history and decisions. And so the reason it was necessary to review the record to the degree and the depth that it was done in that case was because the attorney had no prior way to obtain that knowledge. Here, I think it's reasonable for the court to expect that counsel would have some background knowledge of the case coming in, having represented both the veteran and the appellant in proceedings before the agency and this court for many years. So that would at least the court should look to see if appellant has explained why the time being billed was not duplicative, redundant, or excessive under those circumstances. Those circumstances just were not present in Smith, so the Federal Circuit did not address it. And with regard to Smith,
not to put words into Mr. Raven's mouth, but some of that, though, the familiarity, the duplicative review and all that is built into the rate of review. Couldn't it be argued? I mean, we went through it 500 pages an hour. Why? Because they were familiar, because some of it was duplicative, all that. And so they built it in, and he agreed with that.
That's right, Your Honor. But in that situation, I mean, the distinction here is that many of the records and most of the file really was not, I mean, I guess those efforts were unproductive in the fact that counsel was reviewing thousands of records that were not related to.
I think your relevance argument, but you don't know something's relevant until you look at it and go, nope, that's irrelevant, irrelevant, irrelevant. And you're flying through the record on the irrelevant stuff until you say, that's the one I want. Does that go back to your indexing argument then? They didn't need to do that again because they'd already done that?
Yes, Your Honor. In this case, appellant's counsel did bill for a review of the entire record to index the record, and that should allow counsel to then realize efficiencies in the billing. He hasn't explained why it was necessary to then bill an additional 14.1 hours or 14 hours after that point. And the EJA application itself does explain that on January 26, 2024, counsel had identified the issue for appeal and recommended appeal to the client. So given that explanation in the application, it's unclear to the secretary why that time would be necessary. And it leaves the court and the secretary guessing why it's necessary or why it's not duplicative or excessive or redundant. The application doesn't address it, doesn't explain it. And that is really the reason that the secretary is challenged here is because under the facts and circumstances of this case, it does appear to be duplicative and redundant. And those are factors that are appropriately looked at and considered. And there's no explanation for why it's not. And that's appellant's burden to provide. So we don't have that here. And That is ultimately the issue. It's not a categorical thing. It may be appropriate, but we don't know. We simply don't know. And on that point, with regard to appellant's burden, I would also note that the Aegis statute represents a waiver of sovereign immunity. The government has consented to be sued and to make itself liable for fees in this context. And the waiver of immunity means that this court should construe that waiver narrowly. That goes both to the fact of waiver of sovereign immunity as well as to the scope of the waiver. And here, Congress specifically said that reasonable fees are permitted, not all fees. Not all time billed is reasonable. There's a textual statutory limitation that the fee must be reasonable. And to be reasonable, it cannot be duplicative, excessive, or redundant, et cetera. And looking at the factors from Hensley footnote 3, those may be considered by the court as well, the length of the professional relationship with the client. So all of these things weighing against the reasonableness of the fee, whereas appellant's counsel does present some arguments that weigh for the award of the fee, but really the secretary submits that those should not be found persuasive because they haven't really been explained why it's not duplicative, excessive, and that appellant has not satisfied the burden of demonstrating these fees are reasonable under the court's test, the applicable test, which is a multi-factor test. So counsel did say that Smith created a judicial presumption that record review time was necessary, thus reasonable. And I would just say that Smith really does not, I don't think that's an accurate reading of Smith. Smith did not talk about reasonableness and the amount of time that's reasonable. It just didn't address that issue at all. That's essentially a factual issue over which the Federal Circuit lacks jurisdiction. It would not have addressed that. It can't include that. The decision in Smith was a decision by the Federal Circuit as a matter of law that fees may not be reduced simply because there was an unsuccessful claim in a appeal where there was also a successful claim. That holding doesn't apply to the facts of this case. It's just not relevant. We don't have a situation where we have an unsuccessful and a successful claim. We're not talking about the apportionment of time as a matter of law. So what the Federal Circuit was considering in Smith was a question of law about whether the court had to reduce the fees, but it didn't speak to the factual question of once fees are permitted, how much is reasonable? And that is a factual issue that's firmly within this court's discretion to determine. And the secretary would submit that there are very specific factors that the court can consider and look at to make that determination. And the secretary's briefing has elaborated upon that test and what we believe it should be. Happy to answer any questions about that before wrapping up. But the secretary would ask that the court exercise its discretion to reduce the overall amount of the EJF fees awarded because the amount of time billed by appellant's counsel was appellant did not satisfy their burden of demonstrating that the amount of time billed in the application for merits review was reasonable by explaining why it was not duplicative, redundant, or excessive under the facts and circumstances of this particular case.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Reviewing the record is necessary in any appeal without exception. What is the difference between an index and a merits review? Under the court's rules, the secretary serves the record before the agency on the appellant. The appellant has a period of time to go through the record before the agency to make certain that the record is paginated correctly, the board's decision is the first document in the record, and that all the records that the appellant is aware of are in the record before the agency. If the records are not there, or it's not paginated, or it's not correctly there, the appellant can object and raise objection to any component of the record before the agency. An index is a table of contents. It shows you what documents the board has alluded to and where they are. It is not a merits review. It is simply identifying what the document is and where it can be located. For the most part, it's not clear when the non-attorney practitioner, or in this case, or the paralegal does an index, what the relevancy is, or what is relevant for indexing. A lot of the times when we go through a merits review fills in with notes what is relevant and what is not relevant. The secretary started off by saying we started reading the record at the back. That's not true. We always start by reading the board's decision first to understand what the issues are on appeal, whether the court has jurisdiction, and whether or not the court has to take due account of the rule of prejudicial error to play a game. How would this error be non-prejudicial? The back of the record, the very end of the record, starts off with usually the DD-214. That's page 6578 in the record. A DD-214 shows whether or not the veteran had honorable active service and is eligible and entitled to receive benefits administered by the secretary. It's an important document. Now, going through that, we come up against page 6123 in the record. That's a VA examination. Why is a VA examination relevant to this case? Well, page 6123, and I'm looking at my index, which has notes in it now, page 6123 of the record is a VA examination in which the examiner wrote, he is unemployed. He has worked at various jobs. He cannot keep a steady job because of his back pain. And this VA examination was generated after he filed a claim for increased compensation. That's at page 6143 in the record. This is why we review the entire record for a merits review. We have to see what's relevant. And then we come to a problem area on page 5968. This is an agreement letter signed by Mr. Duckett that indicated that he's satisfied with a 20% rating for his back disability and asked to withdraw his appeal in its entirety. Would it be non-prejudicial error and an appeal for an earlier effective date if the appellant withdrew his appeal for increased compensation? We think there's an argument that the secretary could have made if the secretary had reviewed the record. We had to review the record, a complete merits review, on all these pages in order to be prepared in case the secretary came up with that argument. We would argue no, the withdrawal was only for the back, didn't involve TDIU, which under Rice, as you're familiar with, is reasonably raised with Ingram, reasonably raised by the evidence, and considers all the disabilities and not simply one. And that would have been our argument under 7261, not 51, taking into account of the rule of prejudicial error.
If I could jump in there, getting back to something I asked you before, are these questions that you would have already known the answer to? And I'll point you to a letter that you wrote in January 2022. It's record before the agency at 1565. It's just as an example, you were representing Mrs. Duckett at that point. You talked about that she was a surviving spouse when the veteran died, that at the time of his death, he had a pending appeal before the board, what it was for, that she was seeking substitution, that she was entitled to DIC. So in terms of the secretary's argument that if you already had a pre-existing knowledge of some of these facts, could you not have leveraged some of that to cut down on how much time was spent re-reviewing these documents to determine if he had a pending appeal, for example?
Absolutely. It's reflected in the billing. That's 1,000 pages in 2 hours. That's reflected in the billing. But let's look at that document very clearly. That document, look at the bottom. It has my signature on it, but it's also, it's indicated that JPG wrote it. Initials for Jeffrey Gerber, who was sitting there. Jeffrey Gerber wrote that letter, and it's dated July 22nd, 2022, which I believe is 2 years prior to the appeal before the court. So what I need, what a counsel have obligation under the model rules of professional conduct to do a complete merits review after 2 years of writing that letter? And my answer is yes. That's how I would answer that question. But yes, look.
That it answers the question of whether you could leverage some of your prior knowledge, because presumably you'd already looked at the records that you just spoke to us about a prior appeal, and did he withdraw it? Presumably you knew that before 2022. And the record review we're talking about was in 2024.
But yes, and that's a 2-year gap between the time of record review and writing that. But that's reflected in the speed in which the record was reviewed at 1,000 pages every 2 hours, or 500 pages an hour, approximately. Looking through notes, some of us are great notes takers, and some of us are just horrible at taking notes. If there was an award for taking horrible notes, I would probably win that award. I don't rely upon my notes. My notes are often inaccurate and have wrong dates, and I have to double check things. That's just what I think all attorneys do. I think all attorneys are probably have obsessions of being accurate with information, are obsessive about it. It's important. It's indispensable to review the entire record to get everything right. Even if we have an index of a document, that index doesn't tell us what the relevance of that document is.
Let me try an analogy and see if it resonates with you. I think it might. You're a criminal defense counsel. You represent the client at trial and then on appeal. As part of the trial prep, you've reviewed all the discovery, you sat through the trial, you heard all the testimony and all that, so you're pretty familiar with the case. When you go to appeal, what are you going to do? You're going to review the record, right? Now, that's going to be a narrower subset of what you maybe saw in discovery. It's going to include all the testimony you heard and all that, but it's going to be a smaller amount. It's going to be a more manageable thing because you're looking for errors in the record, right? But it's two different approaches. There are two different lenses that you're looking at the evidence or the record through. One case you're looking at it is, can the government prove my guilt beyond a reasonable doubt? And then the other is, I need to now look and find error that happened at court to try to get the guilty reversal. Is that kind of what you're talking about here? Is it? Yeah, I may have been familiar with it all, but I'm looking for different purposes, different lens.
Exactly. You have to look at it, different standards of review, the rule of taking into account a rule of prejudicial error. You never know going into a conference what the secretary is going to come up with, I think, and you have to be prepared. You have to read the entire record. And in your analogy, even if you represented someone at trial, you still would have an obligation to go through the entire record. What did you get wrong? What did you miss? Why was that decision made? Did you miss something? Can you find it? And is that reasonable to bill your client for that review? Or can you just assume you know everything? And I think it's wrong to assume that you know the record or know specific facts, because I find things all the time that I'm surprised that I missed, or that the law has changed and something is now significant. It's now relevant. But that's the point of having fresh eyes and looking at things again, that ethical responsibility to your client to review the entire record. And that's what Smith talks about.
But Smith ends with this right at the end. There may be instances in which the time spent on reviewing the record is unreasonable. This is not one of them. Smith was not one of them.
I totally agree. And you know, I could come up with an example and say, well, what if I took...
Okay, wait, you just agreed with that sentiment, which is contrary to, hey, this is, you know, per se, I reviewed the record. It met Sperry's 100 pages record. I get it. I get the 14 hours. The 14 hours can still be unreasonable, correct?
I would.
You're just saying under these facts, it was not unreasonable.
I think you could say 14 hours are unreasonable if the record was 100 pages. That's unreasonable. And then we have Sperry for that. And I think that this is saying, look, you can't come into the Veterans Court and review a 10,000-page record and say it took you 1 month or took you 3,000 hours. That's just unreasonable on its face. But, you know, we have an idea about how much time we expect it would take an attorney to reasonably go through a case. Even an attorney who has notes from proceedings down below and is looking at those notes still needs to review the record to make sure that the notes were accurate or to find things that were missed to double check.
So your view is Smith plus Sperry precludes reasonableness, multi-factor analysis.
Yes. Yes. And I think that the Supreme Court in Hensley was clear that a request for attorney fees should not result in a second major litigation. The Secretary's conjecture that it was unnecessary for appellant's counsel to review the record is contrary to Smith. And my time is up, but I do have, in short, record review is indispensable in any appeal, and especially appeals before the Veterans Court. It's the details that matter in every case. And Ms. Duck asked that the court reject the Secretary's allegations and grant the EJ application in full. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The court wants to thank counsel and will come down and greet you. And at this point, the case is submitted. Thank you.
All rise.